First of all, life as a magi was pretty good, at least for the magi that are mentioned in Scripture. We find them both in the Old Testament and here in Matthew in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, we see them in the royal court of the Babylonian and Persian kings, in the books of exile, like in Daniel or Ezra, Nehemiah, Ezekiel. Those books you will find as you're reading through that the magi served as advisors, or as many of our translations have it, as wise men. So when you're reading Daniel and it says, and King Nebuchadnezzar brought all together his wise men and his magicians and so on, the wise men word, the original word in Hebrew is the magi, or in Aramaic, I should say, when it's in Daniel. Though originally thought to be a priestly caste in the ancient Persian religion of Zoroastrianism, I always have had trouble with that word, but that goes way back, way, way back. That's where the magi, the word is first used, but by the time you get to the Babylonian exile, magi refers to these court advisors, men who are known for their religious scholarship, their astrological understanding. Okay, so they were not astronomers, they were astrologists. There's a difference. Also, they were known for their magical incantations and so on. So that's where the connection with magic, magi, magic, that's where that connection comes. And then they were also politicians. They had a lot of political prowess. They knew kind of what was going on in the world. And so they served the kings of Babylonia and Persia to give guidance to the king, much as Israel's kings relied on prophets like Elijah or Isaiah. The Babylonian kings relied on these magi. Well, in the New Testament, this unusual passage that we just read in Matthew is the only place that we find the magi show up, and that's not surprising. Our text tells us that their presence in Jerusalem was something of a surprise, and it really shook things up for King Herod and for the entire court there in Jerusalem. But I don't want to get ahead of ourselves when it comes to the story. These magi trekked across at least 900 miles of rough terrain to pay homage to the King of the Jews, as much as 2 years after the birth of Jesus. And though some of the gaps in the story have to be filled in with educated guesses, today I want to kind of take that journey with them from Persia to Bethlehem. What moved them? How did they get there? What were they doing over that period of time? Because you see, over the last couple of weeks, we've been asking a question of a few poor, disenfranchised, alienated Jews. Okay, who played a part in the coming of Messiah. We were asking them a question. Specifically, we asked Mary, and then last week we asked the shepherds why they were celebrating the Jubilee of God, even though their personal circumstances would certainly not warrant such a celebration. Even though they were poor, even though they were disenfranchised, even though they were disadvantaged and alienated from their society, still they were celebrating. Still they had this sense of jubilee. We find them reveling in the jubilee of God, even when nobody else could see it. In our last two messages, we pondered the question of why this jubilee? Just like the old Christmas hymn, shepherds, why this jubilee? We thought it was a good question. But at least they were Jews, and they were participating in the coming of a Jewish Messiah. That was the source of their jubilee. But why these wealthy, influential foreigners, Gentiles, if you will, from the courts of a pagan world power, why they would be celebrating the jubilee of God? I don't know. Why would they have an interest in a centuries-old prophecy of an obscure and unusual religion? And I say unusual because the morality of Judaism was very unusual across the world at that time. Religion was not usually tied into morality. Jews would only marry other Jews. That was an odd thing. This was something that was different from the rest of the world. And so this was, it was obscure, and that was from this little backwater region of the world, a place, a very tiny little country. And this religion, and yet it was obscure, and yet here they were interested in the prophecies of this. And so I want to start by at the beginning of their quest and journey, asking why. What's their interest? Why are they journeying to the Jubilee of God, if you will? For while the Magi planned this long journey, they were not planning for what they found on the other end of the desert. They weren't planning to find the Son of God. Recounting the planning stages of this journey requires some educated guesses on our part, and so we'll take what we know about the Magi and we'll try and fill in what could be, might have been in the process, because the Bible only gives us some clues. It seems apparent that these Magi were practitioners of ancient astrology, which sought to gain wisdom and knowledge through their study of the stars. Now, there are some people who are into astrology big time today, but for the most part, astrology today is mostly thought of as kind of entertainment, like fortune cookies at Chinese restaurants, you know. But in those days, it was considered a science. In fact, one of the earliest sciences. And the Medo-Persians and Babylonian kings wanted to follow the science as much as any of our leaders do today. And so they would bring in their scientists, their magi. So Matthew's magi were astrologers. And one night, as they were scanning the western skies, they happened upon something brilliant and new. It hadn't been there the day before. And the Bible seems to indicate that it wasn't there long, maybe even just one night. Now, as an aside, let me clarify some of these things that I'm saying, because it doesn't comport well with even the song that we just sang in terms of the star and the wise men and the traveling and all of that. The Bible says nothing about Magi following the star day by day on their long journey like our Christmas cards and Christmas carols do. This is based on tradition. The Greek in Matthew chapter 2, verse 2 is very clear that the Magi were speaking in the past tense when they said, "Where is he who was born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." Now, let me also point out, because I know some of your minds are going, wait a minute, that's not how the King James had it when I was little. It was, we saw his star in the east and have come to worship him. So let me explain a little bit of a cultural quirk, if you will. In the East is the literal reading of that word, okay? In fact, you find it in chapter 2, verse 1, I believe, when it says that wise men from the East came. And that is the way that you would interpret that, that they came from the East. However, if we saw this star in the East, and they were already in the East, then the star would have been over India, not over Judea. And it's not referencing them, it's referencing the star. It's not saying, when we were in the east, we saw the star. That's not what it says. It says, when we were in the east, I'm sorry, it says, we saw the star in the east, is what we saw. Well, that doesn't make any sense. They wouldn't have seen it in the eastern sky, not from where they were perched. However, there is a usage that we find in ancient texts in Greek in which the in the east is also the way of talking about the rising of someone or something. Why? Because, well, the sun rose in the east. And so the connection was, if you use the phrase in the east to describe a rising, you can rising out of bed, rising of a star, rising, it simply means a rising. And that is another usage of this in Old Testament, and I'm sure I should say in New Testament Greek, in Koine Greek. So, but you have to choose according to the context. In this context, it makes no sense in terms of that the star itself was in the eastern sky, because they were already in the east. But rather to say, we saw the star when it rose, plus it was past tense, by the way. And so it is past tense. And so it says, we saw the star when it rose, when it first appeared. We saw it. But understand that this is in the past tense. The Greek, if it had wanted to say, we saw the star, okay, and I don't want to get in the weeds here, but if it wanted to say, we saw the star and I have continued to see it, Okay, there is a tense cult for that. It's called the aorist tense. It means that we saw it and we are continuing to see it. But that's not the tense that was used here. The tense that was used here is the past tense. We saw his star when it rose, and we have come to worship him. Had the star still been present, they could have taken Herod out to see it. We saw his star. You want to see it? Come on. Wouldn't that be the most natural thing? There it is. But instead, Herod called them in to find out when they saw the star. When did you see this? That was Herod's question. When did it appear? How long ago? Verse 7 says, then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. Past tense. So the Magi here, they spot what they believe to be a star, or at least an astrological event. They spot this while they are in Persia, somewhere in the Persian, Babylonian, Median area over there, around Iraq, Iran, what we know today. They spot the star, and as astrologers, they are pretty familiar with the night sky. Okay, it's not like they're new to this. So one would think that they would have a pretty good idea of the difference between a comet and a planet and a star. You know, we think that these are things that we discovered. No, the astrologers have been scanning the sky ever since they opened their eyes and looked up. And therefore, they can notice that planets move, they can notice that comets have tails, that there are differences in celestial bodies. So the idea that they might have been something else than a star, well, it's hard to believe, but and yet this star did not behave like most stars. So it was intriguing. This star appeared, but then it disappeared. In a night sky where there were no satellites, no aircraft, no weather balloons, anything else that could confuse anybody as to what was up there, this star did not go unnoticed. And since everything in the night sky had meaning to an astrologer, a group of magi formed around this unusual occurrence. They had spotted this star. It was gone the next day, and it's like, okay, that means something. What might it mean? And so they would begin the research phase of their investigation. Why? Because they're scientists. First of all, who else saw the star? You know, in our movies and stuff, you always have three guys all together. You know, it's like watching some TV show with three single dudes all sharing the same apartment, and they're all looking at the star at the same time from the same place. That's pretty unlikely. And so the question of you know, who saw the star would be something that the Magi would begin to talk about. Did you see the other night when we were out? Well, I didn't see that. I was looking out east and you were looking west. No, so they start communicating more than likely to discover who else saw this star. And anyone who saw it would have found great interest in it. Second, the question was, where in the sky was it? Okay, we know it was west, but where? Now, understand, they would have charted the star. They charted all the stars. And if they spotted a new one, they would have taken out and started charting to figure out where on the horizon this star was located. And what they discovered was that somehow or other it was located over what would be Israel, old Israel or Judea today, or in that day. This had significance. See, for some of us, we would have thought, oh, it was over Judea. That's great. But for these astrologers, it had significance because there had long been an expectation across the east of a coming power that would arise out of the region of the world where the Jews lived, that they would come from Judea, that this power, even among non-Jews, even among the pagans, we learned of this expectation, not from the Bible or from even from a Jewish source, but rather we learn of it from a first century Roman historian. His name was Gaius Suetonius, who wrote a biography of the first 12 Caesars of Rome. Sounds like a real page turner. In his chapter on Caesar Vespasian, he writes this: throughout the whole of the East, understand that they thought of Rome as in the West. So he says, throughout the whole of the East, there had spread an old and persistent belief. Destiny had decreed that at that time, men would come forth from Judea and seize power and rule the world. So there was this underlying motif in across the East that says, watch out for Judea. Keep an eye out on Judea. There's going to be a time when there's going to be power coming out of Judea. Where that came from, we have no idea. So the location of the star over Judea might have pricked a particular interest in the minds of these astrologers who spotted the star. In fact, it might have even pricked an interest in the minds of the kings that these astrologers served, seeing as a power coming out of the west would be a pretty dangerous thing. So the next phase of the investigation would be to try to discover the significance of the star. Does this star mean something? The idea of a star heralding something something new, like the birth of a new king, was well accepted in the culture of the Magi. Other kings had been heralded by stars. So was there any, of course, the trouble was that they were heralded by stars, but none of the people who had seen it were alive. But now they were alive, and there's a star, and so they question, is there any reference to a star in ancient Jewish prophetic literature? That's where they would go. Why? Because it's over Judea. Fortunately, the Magi would not have to go far to look for clues. The Babylonian exile of the Jews in the region of Babylon had happened about 500 years previous and had left many enclaves of Jews still living in the region who still practiced Judaism. See, not all the Jews returned to Jerusalem. Many of them stayed in Babylon and continued to live there. In fact, there are still Jewish enclaves in Iraq and Iran. And so what you have here is that there were rabbinical schools that had been developed in that region, in Persia. So as scholars, it would not have taken the Magi long to discover, to go to those schools and begin to look through the scriptures that they had there at those schools. And as they looked, they would discover Numbers 24:17, a prophecy of the prophet Balaam, who doesn't get a lot of positive press, but because he was a very reluctant prophet, and he was a prophet for profit, but God used him anyway. And it says this, verse 17 of Numbers 24, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise up out of Israel. So this star that they saw, this star was connected to the coming of a Jewish king. That was where the mind of the astrologers would go. It's a fulfillment of a prophecy. See, one of the things we have to remember is that in those days, it's not like I believe in God here, and my God, and your God is a bunch of phooey. Okay? But rather, they believed that there were multiple gods that were regional and that they spoke to the people of their own regions. And so it made sense that is why the king of Persia, Darius, sent the Jews back to rebuild their temple, because he wanted to be in the good graces of the God of the region of Judea. And to be in his good graces, you have to have his temple rebuilt. And so he did that. So the Magi would have read these scriptures and thought, hey, the God of Israel is going to send a king, and this is going to happen, and there's going to be a star. And it wasn't just any king, but the one that the Jews called the Anointed One, the Messiah. Well, there was only one thing left to do at that point. Like any good scientist of our day, a group of Magi decided to travel to Jerusalem, the capital of Judea, and find this newborn king who had been heralded by a star in the heavens. And while the tradition of the Western Church tells us that there were three Magi who made that journey, that's based solely on the number of gifts that were given. There is no indication of the number. The Eastern Church has a tradition that says there were 12 Magi on the journey. Although that might well be tied to the 12 tribes of Israel and the use of it in the 12 apostles and so on. The truth is, we don't know how many magi were a part of the investigation. We don't know how many traveled. We also don't know their names, as some would indicate that we do. That's a tradition as well. And we don't know where they specifically came from. Even though tradition tells us Persia, India, and one other place, I can't remember. But whether it be 3 or 12 or 20, the traveling caravan that would accompany these magi would be pretty significant. For they brought very expensive gifts with them, so they needed protection. And they themselves were accustomed to the finer things of life, so they would probably bring fancy tents, like all the things you see in the movies, the fancy tents and the beds, and they were probably carried around by servants, or they might have ridden camels themselves, it doesn't say. But there would have been servants who took care of the animals, and there would be servants to cook meals, and there would be servants to set up and break down camp, and then there would be personal attendants for the magi themselves, and probably a troop of soldiers to protect them because they've got all this gold and frankincense and myrrh with them. And so this was a pretty good-sized group of people, an entourage, if you will. And they would be traveling 900 miles or so from Persia or Babylon to Jerusalem. They would have to go around the desert. So they'd follow the river Euphrates up, and then they'd curl around what was Haran, and they'd come back down the fertile, and kind of move around the desert. Now, I read, you know that you can still take a camel ride on the Silk Road. It's not. Oh well, it's a road between China and the Middle East, Iraq, Iran, that area. And you can actually still take a camel ride. And what they say is that a camel, when loaded with about 600 pounds, can do about 18 miles a day. So you would have to plan on 18 miles a day. If you were going 900 miles, that means it would take, without stops, without any rest, about 50 days if you're doing 18 miles a day. Now, these guys are, like I say, they're kind of soft. They're wealthy. They're probably not accustomed to hard travel. So you can guess at least 2 months on the road with these camels and all the servants. So by the time they arrive in Jerusalem, after discovering the star, investigating its meaning, and organizing an expedition, and then actually traveling there, it has been nearly 2 years since they actually saw the star. We know this because Herod asked them, when did you first see the star? And then later, when he sends out his troops to kill the children in Bethlehem, he orders that it be 2 years or younger, all the male children 2 years or younger. And why? And it says specifically, according to what he had ascertained from the wise men. And so we know it was about 2 years after the birth of Christ that these wise men or magi showed up in Jerusalem. So what did they find? When they finally pulled up into Jerusalem, the whole caravan comes in. A stop, by the way, that only serves to reinforce the notion that the magi were not following the star at this point. Because why would it have taken them to Jerusalem and not straight to Bethlehem? If the star was leading them, why didn't it lead them directly to Jesus and stop off in Jerusalem to let Herod in on the secret that the King of the Jews has been born? At any rate, when the Magi enter Jerusalem, it's not with little fanfare. I mean, everybody knows about it. There's this huge caravan, and they head to the palace only to find that no one seems to know what they're talking about. No one seems to have seen a star a couple of years ago. It's not on anybody's radar. They can't find it on the internet. There's no conversation about the young prince. No excitement over prophecy's fulfillment. Nothing. In fact, it seemed like it was news to the king, King Herod, that there had been any kind of birth at all. I mean, they had served kings in the court. They know what it is to be called in by the king to say, hey, tell me what's going on here. They saw that look. And in fact, he said he had to send to his advisors to discover from the Old Testament prophets just where this Messiah was supposed to be born. Can you imagine for a moment what the Magi must have been thinking and feeling at that moment? After 2 years of research, planning, travel, all of this, could they have been wrong? I mean, they get there and nobody knows anything about it. Not only did these people not have a clue as to the coming of their own Messiah, they seemed downright troubled by it. The Magi were the most excited people in the room. And then there was that secret meeting with the king where he pressed them for just when did the star, when did they spot it? And if they saw the star all the way over there in Persia, how is it possible that it could go unnoticed in Jerusalem? One would expect that it would have to have lit up the whole landscape like some supercharged full moon if it was something that they could see in Persia. But nothing. Nada, nobody talking about it. The disappointment would have been overwhelming. The self-doubt. I mean, 2 years of time and the enormous expense of a traveling caravan only to discover that there's nothing to it. In fact, when they were given directions to the town in which this Messiah was supposed to have been born, no one from the palace was even sent to show them the way. This is how disinterested everybody was in Jerusalem. The Magi had traveled 900 miles to find this Messiah king. No one from Jerusalem, a politician, a religious leader, nobody would go 6 miles to find him. Not even 6 miles. Herod says, you know, you go and find him, and you know, when you find him, come and tell me. And I'll go worship him too. What would they do now? I mean, what would you be thinking at that point? They just go home, tail between their legs, report that they've just wasted enormous amounts of time and resources on a wild goose chase? If they had been sent by a king to investigate this, how do you think the king might respond to that? Or do they go to this Bethlehem and begin asking around, looking like a bigger bunch of fools every door they knock on? Hello, yes, I know I look like a wise man. Have you heard anything about a Messiah? Just say it. Nothing. Okay, thank you. We'll check the neighbor. I mean, how are they going to find this Messiah? And where do you park a caravan? In the streets, in the little narrow streets of Bethlehem. Where do you put them? How could they have been so wrong? All their science, all their research, all their committee meetings, all of the conversations, all for nothing. I mean, this isn't like losing a Super Bowl. This is like traveling to the game only to discover that there was a mistake and your team wasn't invited. I think the Magi would have been crushed. Well, evening was coming. They were wandering around trying to figure out what to do, and it was at this point that the impossible happened. And behold, the star that they had seen, past tense, when it rose, went before them. It's back. Until it came to rest over the place where the child was. Verse 10 says, when they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. Again, here's one of those translations. It's like, yes, we rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. Nobody talks like that. But the star that had appeared to them 2 years earlier, suddenly, at the perfect time, appears to them again. But that's impossible, right? Right. That's impossible. Stars don't just come and go. Comets do, but they take hundreds of years to make their rounds. Planetary convergences do, but again, there are centuries between the events. These seasoned astrologers would know this. They would know that stars don't behave this way, and their response to the appearance of the star demonstrates this. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. The translation here does not translate well the depth of the emotion experienced by these scholars and scientists, the depth of the emotion that's communicated in the Greek text. Here's just a few other ways that these words are translated by translators into English to try to convey the depth of their joy. The Magi were ecstatic with joy, shouting with unrestrained joy, overwhelmed with joy. They were overjoyed beyond measure. Their joy knew no bounds, or as Eugene Peterson paraphrased in The Message, they could hardly contain themselves. They were that excited. I mean, these are scholars. In those days, of course, these highfalutin, really high-end, top-of-the-line people they did not demonstrate their emotions like this. But they were absolutely overcome with joy. Suffice it to say, we had very happy Magi. But why? Magi, why this jubilee? Was it because the star was back? Well, on the face of it, we might think so. But here, it's not because the star was back. It's because the star couldn't be back. There was no way the star could be back, and yet there it was. What had started out as a scientific investigation had suddenly become a divine invitation. Only God could place that star back in place at just this moment. The God of the Jews was specifically inviting them, a group of pagan Gentiles who made a livelihood out of practicing the dark arts that were forbidden by this very same God. And yet, here he was inviting them, this holy God, inviting them to come to see his anointed. This wasn't just an invitation to learn more. It was an invitation to enter into the jubilee of God. So they gleefully followed a star that can't be a star. For it leads them not just to Bethlehem. The star leads them to the very house where they will find the Messiah. No star can do that. There is not a high-end microscope or telescope in our world today that can tell you that a particular star happens to be over your house and not the one next door. And yet this star did that. And amazingly, when the Magi get there, it's not a palace. It's not even a mansion. Frankly, it's not even a nice place. It's probably a rental. Something Joseph picked up in order to find work. A place for his family to live until he could make enough money to make his way back to Nazareth. They were a poor people. The trip, apparently, that he'd been waiting to make for at least 2 years. Nothing here was as they expected it. Nothing is as the world said it should be. The people in power know nothing. A star comes and goes and directs and leads. The Messiah King plays in a small tattered rental while his mother watches and his stepfather, quote, works late, probably, as a common carpenter. After all, they got there by following a star. So somewhere along the line, it's at least evening. It's dark. See, this is not the Magi's world. This is not how the world works. It's upside down. It's backwards. It's a world that's full of God's values and reeks of God's desires. And it's completely different. Totally at odds with what the world says. The world that the Magi lived in all the time. And yet, even though this was, the Magi were completely at odds with this, rather than despise them or dismiss them or even destroy them, God invites them. He invites them to the feet of the Savior. He doesn't invite just the Jews. He invites the whole world. He doesn't invite just the down and out, like Mary and the shepherds. But he invites the up and out, like the Magi. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell down and worshiped him. The Magi didn't understand much at this point. I'm sure their minds were swirling with a mixture of confusion and joy, you know, denial and acceptance, all kinds of contradictions, nothing making sense. But that star, if it truly was a star, it led them here. It led them to this child. He was the culmination of their journey. He was the subject of their quest. They went, though, looking for a political king. What they found was a Savior, the point of God's very personal invitation to them. An invitation that God had extended. He began the invitation 2 years earlier, when God had revealed to them his glory in the western skies. Knowing that there would be this compelling thing inside of them, that their commitment to error, okay, astrology, that their commitment to error would lead them to the truth if they would follow him that far. He made a compelling call on their lives to come and see what he was doing. Now, you know, I have no evidence for this, but I like to think that what they saw was the same Shekinah glory that the shepherds observed that night on the hillsides outside of Bethlehem. I mean, after all, what does it say? Luke says that when the angel appeared to them, the glory of the Lord shone round about them, all around them. The whole hillside was lit with the glory of God. Perhaps it was high enough and bright enough to be seen by a group of astrologers in Persia as well. I don't know. People will come to me and say, "Hey, did you see the northern lights the other night?" "No, I wish I had. Didn't see them." "Well, they were right out there." "I know, I just didn't see them. I didn't look." "Oh, you weren't looking." In any event, what was clear to the Magi was that they had been invited and led to meet Jesus. And they did not, and they did the only thing at that point that was appropriate. They fell on their knees and worshiped. You know, the first thing I thought of when I read that again was the song "I Can Only Imagine." I can only imagine what I'll do when I'm in your presence. Will I dance? Will I sing? Will I be able to speak? Will I fall on my knees? What will I do? Well, the Magi have the answer to their question. They fell on their faces and worshiped. Jesus once told a Samaritan woman at the well, "You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We Jews worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him." Even Magi. The Magi didn't fully understand all the ins and outs of what God was doing here. They didn't need to. All they knew was that God had invited them to be a part of his jubilee, and he was in the process of turning the world upside down, and he wanted them to be a part of it. That's what they knew. Turning the point of wealth, the point of having wealth and power on its head, so that it no longer serves itself but sacrifices itself to serve others. They had served self-centered kings in Persia. They had firsthand experience of the powers of this world. And they had just been in the halls of wealth and power in Jerusalem, and what they found was a people that were wholly unaware of what God was doing under their noses, even though they were steeped in the scriptures that told them it was coming. Don't you see the irony of this? That when the wise men, the Magi, get there, who are looking, seeking desperately after God, though not knowing anything, you had them going to a people who knew everything, but were not seeking after God. They had the scriptures, and they could tell them in a moment's time where to find the Messiah, and they didn't care. It was just information. In fact, the notion of a Messiah's arrival troubled them all because they saw it as a threat to their power and their position. But now, in this humble home, all dressed in their fine clothes and bedecked with jewels, these Magi found themselves on their faces on the dirt floor, worshiping the toddler that would save the world and them, saving us from such arrogance and ruthless selfishness. Nothing else mattered to them at that moment. Nothing else mattered but Jesus, to whom God had personally led them. Magi, why this jubilee? What's interesting to me is, as I've gone through this series, is that it's for the same reason that Mary and the shepherds were filled with jubilee. You notice that? The jubilee was because God took notice of them. He cared for them, and then he personally invited them to join him in experiencing and spreading his jubilee throughout the whole world. Whether it was a dirt poor, pregnant, disenfranchised woman, a cast off, dirty, and despised group of shepherds, or highly educated, wealthy, yet clueless Magi, God lovingly goes out of his way to invite them. To invite them to abandon this world's broken system of selfishness and arrogance and enter into his jubilee. And he still invites us. Now, if we were to look at these characters from the story, which ones are most like us? The the dirt poor, pregnant woman, the dirty and alienated, despised shepherds, or the wealthy and educated wise men. Now, we'll say, well, we're not rich. Well, come on. Compared to the rest of the world, we're filthy rich. So, well, we're not particularly educated. Compared to what? We're highly educated. Well, we have no power. Are you kidding? We are a democratic republic. We have more power in our voting booths than most nations, most peoples in most nations have dreamed of. We make choices for ourselves. We decide for ourselves. We do what we want, when we want, because we want it. Who are we most like from these stories? I ask that because the invitation is based on who we are. You know, God sent an angel to Mary for a private conversation. He sent a choir to the shepherds who were amazed and dumbstruck and rushed off to see what they were singing about. And he sent a star to the Magi because he knew that the Magi thought they knew something. He knew that the Magi would believe in their own abilities and their own powers to deduce things, to figure things out. They had the resources to do what they wanted, when they wanted. And so God placed a star in their way. And then just let them do what they normally do until they came to the point where they discovered, it seemed, that they were totally, totally wrong. And then God showed them what he really had called them to Jerusalem to see. Not some geopolitical king, some new prince in some palace, but the Savior of the world, who would forego all of the trappings of glory and power and wealth in order to save those who are down and out and those who are up and out. So he is inviting us. He continues to invite us to enter into relationship with him, to enter into this jubilee of God where we find our rest with him, or to go deeper into that jubilee. You know, you might not be using a star in the sky, but if you look and you listen, you will hear that still small voice of God inviting you as well. For Jesus continues to call as he did in Matthew 11, 28 and 29. He says this, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." Rest. "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." The Magi that day found rest after all of their investigation, all of their research, all of their trapping, all of their disappointment, all of the everything. When they finally got to the home and discovered the King of the Jews, they fell at his feet and found rest for the first time in their lives. This is offered to all of us And friends, this is Jubilee. Let's pray together. Father in heaven, we're grateful today for this amazing story of how you reached out and called not just wayward Jews, but arrogant, self-involved, powerful, wealthy magi. Practiced things that were abhorrent to your people because they were abhorrent to you, and yet still you reached out to them. Still you placed a star in the sky for them. Still you came to them at their moment of need, and you led them directly all the way to the feet of your Son. Lord, do that. Continue to do that among us and in us today. Help us, Father, to let go of our, what the Bible used to call our vainglory. This sense of personal greatness. And let us find our value and our worth, our life and our rest in you, where there is nothing to prove, nothing to demonstrate, nothing to achieve or to accomplish, but the invitation to walk with you and to be influenced and empowered by your Spirit to accomplish what it is that you choose on your timetable, for your glory, for your praise, as we find our identity and our life in you. Thank you for your good grace and mercy. In Jesus' name.